May it please the court. There is nothing complex about Mr. Wright's case. Everyone, including the trial judge, tried this murder case as though the sole issue was self-defense. But when it came time to provide the legally required jury instructions, the trial court committed harmful and reversible error by refusing to provide those jury instructions. The trial court doubled down on this error when the jury asked for the law on self-defense, and the trial court, in its response, commented on the evidence. Without such jury instructions, there may as well have been no trial at all. The trial court's legal error eviscerated Mr. Wright's sole legal and factual defense. It's because of this that we're asking that this court reverse the trial court's judgment and remand this case for a new trial. In Texas, the Court of Criminal Appeals has held that evidence establishing elements of a self-defense jury instruction, this evidence may be weak, it may be strong, it may be unimpeached, or it may be contradicted. But a defendant is still entitled to the instruction so long as the elements are met. All that is needed for the trial court to submit the issue to the jury is a scintilla of evidence from any source that raises the defensive issue. This holds true.
But in this case, I think that the issue is not is the issue of one of whether the presumption was carried in this case because Mr. Wright, a convicted felon, had a gun. I mean, I think that's where the whole risk of this case is, isn't it? And so how do we overcome that presumption or the presumption that he doesn't get it as a convicted felon?
Actually, Your Honor, I disagree respectfully. That's not the law. Under 9.32, the issue of a presumption of reasonableness, that presumption is afforded to somebody using deadly force in self-defense, unless they are committing a crime. What happens then under 9.32 is of the Penal Code is that the presumption of reasonableness is no longer there. The question of reasonableness is for the jury to decide, not the judge. The fact finder gets to evaluate whether or not Mr. Wright was reasonable. He still has the right to raise that self-defense theory and to get that self-defense instruction.
But wouldn't that mean that they're always entitled to a self-defense instruction if they just raise it?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. As Mendoza v. State, and actually the case we cite in our letter brief, Jordan v. State, makes clear, there has to be a scintilla of evidence from any source establishing the elements. And the evidence established at trial met those elements.
Well, counsel, let's talk a little bit about the evidence. Obviously, the appellant did not know that Mr. Barrios, the deceased, was armed. He didn't know that he was drugged. He didn't know any of those things, did he?
Respectfully disagree, Your Honor. While the fact that Mr. Barrios was high on a cocktail of drugs that made him believe he was invincible and bulletproof was not factually known to the defendant, if you look back at Court's Exhibit E, his grand jury testimony, Mr. Barrios's behavior was so violent and so strange that Mr. Wright testified to the grand jury, it was though he was on drugs. It appeared as though he was on drugs. So this behavior was so apparently bizarre that even an average person reasonably believed somebody was on drugs. As for Mr. Barrios being armed, again, the events transpired so quickly, fulfilling that element of imminence that's required under the statute, that it would be hard for any person to tell one way or the other. What Mr. Wright testified before the grand jury is that Mr. Barrios charged at him with clenched fists. But your question about the evidence also brings up a really important aspect of the law that this court should consider, which the Court of Criminal Appeals highlighted yesterday in their decision of Jordan v. State, which we included with our letter brief. To qualify for a self-defense instruction with the use of deadly force, there doesn't have to be evidence that the victim was attempting or actually used unlawful deadly force against the actor. Rather, what's important here is that there was an apparent danger and that the actor reasonably apprehended this danger. Here, the facts The record is replete with facts that allow for such a reasonable conclusion. And in fact, I'll go over those facts in a minute. They're on the demonstrative we provided to you. But it's not just our say-so. The trial court itself thought these facts were sufficient enough that it stated on the record twice that the defense had raised self-defense and it was allowing in evidence to rebut this defense. You can't have it both ways. You can't say that a defense was raised and you're going to allow in evidence to rebut it, and then later on say that the defense wasn't raised.
Are you raising a issue on appeal of improper evidence admitted to the court? Because the state makes an argument in footnote one of their brief that those are not issues you're raising. You're not raising an evidentiary issue and or a, if I can get it right, an evidentiary really or a comment on the jury verdict, but only that the self-defense instruction are given. Are you raising other issues besides the failure to give a self-defense instruction?
So to answer Your Honor's first question, as far as the, are we raising an issue, a legal issue, as far as the error to admit evidence, we did not raise that issue as to the whether the trial court abused its discretion. We just point out to the court the sort of catch-22 that the defendant was in, right? But we did raise and address the state's argument as to the jury instruction and the court. That is a separate legal issue that we believe this court could consider. And we amended our brief. We disagree with the state. We don't think it was a multifarious argument in our brief. But then this court granted our motion to amend our original brief. And so as a separate issue, we raised that when the jury sent out a note saying, what is the law on self-defense? Can you tell us what the Texas law is? And the trial court commented on the evidence by saying, I have already ruled that self-defense does not apply. You are not to consider self-defense. That was a comment on the evidence.
And that's a separate issue that you bring up. But let's go back to what you said about the judge allowing rebuttal evidence with regards to self-defense. Now, just because the defendant raises self-defense through, I guess it would have to be through cross-examination of direct testimony from the state, he believed, or if it's brought up, that doesn't mean it's necessarily true. And that's why they would allow rebuttal evidence. And in that case, the judge could decide whether that rebuttal evidence was sufficient to disallow the self-defense instruction. Do you agree with that?
I don't, Your Honor. And here's why, for a couple of different reasons.
Well, but then that would just mean if you just bring it up, you know, one question, one answer, then you're entitled to the jury instruction.
But that's not the case here. And Your Honor, if I may, also what the law says in Gilboa v. State, which we cite in our letter brief, and the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals also says, is that in determining whether the testimony of a defendant or anyone else raises an issue of self-defense, the truth or credibility of that testimony is not the issue for the trial court to decide. There just has to be some evidence that fulfills the elements. And as the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals said in Jordan, it can be weak, it can be contradicted, it can be strong. There just has to be a scintilla of evidence.
Let me ask you a question also on the facts. Was there any testimony or anything in the trial that the drugs and or the money were in the actual bedroom where the defendant was located?
Yes, Mrs. Barrios testified to that. And I believe Mr. Wright also in the grand jury testimony testified that there were drugs and money in the room.
In the actual bedroom where the defendant was located.
Yes, Your Honor, in the actual bedroom. So let's also get to that for a moment. The facts show that Mr. Wright is in an apartment that he's only been to once before in the middle of night with a woman next to him who's communicating with some unknown person on a cell phone. They hear glass breaking. A man who has jumped over a cement wall, broken through a glass patio door, charges in. Mrs. Barrios leaves the room, partially shuts the door, leaving Mr. Wright there. The next thing he knows, he hears shouting in the hall, a male voice, and someone barges through the door, dressed in black and blue, and charges at him. And he tells that person, hold up, and points a gun to him. The man doesn't stop, and Mr. Wright repeatedly testified at the grand jury he thought the man was going to attack him. I point your honors to the facts in Gilboa v. State, where the 14th Court of Appeals found on very similar facts when the actor, the defendant, shot and killed somebody who was charging at him with no apparent weapon. Rather, what that actor said, what that defendant said, is he thought he was about to receive the beating of his life. It's the apparent danger. And the facts show that Mr. Wright was reasonable in believing that he was in danger and about to be robbed. I reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Doug Norman for the state, counsel. I think the state would first like to concede that on the question of whether a self-defense issue should have been given to the jury, this is a close case. I mean, we'll concede that. I'm not going to hide that. The reason we think that we win on this is based on the difference between a reasonable inference and speculation. The trial court has to give.
So let me stop you there.
Yes.
If it's a, my understanding that in reviewing, though, this, I always go back to, okay, what lens are we looking at this case? So if it's a closed case, are we not reviewing the self-instruction charge, though, as a matter of law as to whether this trial should have been given it or not?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay. So how do we get past the what you argue in your brief that is speculation and inference as to whether it is at a matter of law? If it's a close, which way do we go?
Well, the trial, beg your pardon, this court has to make a really difficult decision because the line between inference and speculation is not always clear. This is basically a legal sufficiency question. Is there a scintilla of evidence on which a reasonable jury could have accepted that this was self-defense and not an attack which would be unjustified?
Well, counsel, the fact that the jury sent out a question regarding whether they could consider self-defense, I mean, don't you think that that certainly weighs to the fact that maybe the jury wanted to consider that and wasn't allowed to consider that because the judge decided that it shouldn't go to the jury? I mean, isn't that indicative also that that it should have gone to the jury if the jury wanted to answer that question, or it appears that the jury wanted to answer that question?
Well, I would respectfully submit, Judge, that we don't look to the jury to decide whether it's been raised or not. We look simply to the evidence presented. And I understand the jury sent out a note, but the jury doesn't have the legal knowledge to know what does and does not qualify as self-defense. That's purely a legal question based on the evidence that's presented at the time the charge is submitted. So I would ask the court not to look to the note.
Well, let's talk about the note a little bit further, though. Do you think that it was error in and of itself that the court did not just simply say refer to the charge, but instead elaborated in the response to that question?
I would suggest the court probably should have just sent a note saying just refer to the charge. But I would submit that that's not really raised as a separate identifiable point of error. Really, the only point of error that was raised in point of error number one is the question of whether or not there was sufficient evidence for them to get the charge. The other issues are sort of collateral to that. And so the state would suggest that it's, you know, unless the court were to review it as a multifarious point of error, the only real issue is whether they were entitled to that submission of the self-defense issue.
So you're saying that even if we were to decide that he wasn't entitled to the self-instruction charge, that would terminate everything and we wouldn't have to look at the comment on the weight of the evidence that the court made?
I think so, Your Honor. I think, okay. You know, you're only allowed to raise one point or one, you know, complaint per point of error. If they had wanted to raise a separate point of error, they certainly could have and raised that as a separate issue. But the crux of their point of error was they were entitled to a self-defense instruction. They did not get it. If we can rebut that and show, no, they were not entitled to it, I think we're entitled to win on issue number one.
So you're not disagreeing that the trial court improperly commented on the state on the issue that there was an improper comment on the law when the note was responded to the way it was?
I don't know that I would concede that, Your Honor, but I didn't believe it was before the court, so I didn't fully brief that issue. If it was a comment, you know, the comment was simply don't consider self-defense, which the court, you know, it was probably if we're correct that self-defense was not before them, it was a proper comment, although it probably went beyond the scope of anything the trial court should have been saying. It's as if the trial court said, and don't consider this other element that we haven't submitted to you that's not, we found is not applicable to the case.
Well, counsel for the appellant said that without the self-defense instruction in the jury charge, there might as well have been no trial, because that's a risk you take when you're going to your trial strategy is self-defense, because you have to otherwise admit to the other acts, correct?
Correct.
So right. What you're saying is if he wasn't entitled to the self-defense instruction, then the comment on the question was really harmless.
I would say so.
Really, the jury had no choice but then to find him guilty.
I think so, Your Honor, unless they disbelieved one of the other elements. And the opposing counsel cites a recent case, Jordan, which was decided just yesterday by the Court of Criminal Appeals. And we don't disagree. Certainly, I think we would agree with all the law that's stated in Jordan. There's nothing that really changes the law except when it comes to multiple assailants. But it's interesting to note that in Jordan, not only was there an assault, but there were a few other things that occurred there that really distinguished this case from Jordan. In Jordan, at the time the assault occurred, there were multiple assailants that came down on two people, the defendant and one of his companions. They knocked the companion. They hit him so hard he was knocked out. He was knocked unconscious. They then knocked the defendant to the ground. And in doing so, what they did was they fishhooked his eye, which indicates that they grabbed the eye socket, pulled him around, and threw him to the ground. Now, fishhooking the eye in itself suggests what would probably be considered deadly force, because certainly fishhooking an eye could cause you to lose sight in that eye and could cause permanent damage to that eye. In addition to that, when they got him on the ground there, there were multiple assailants that were hovering over him. Now, none of that happened in our case. There's no suggestion of that degree of force in our case.
Well, but in that case, in the Jordan case, the one of the victims was the girlfriend, and there was no ex-girlfriend, I guess. There was no evidence that the ex-girlfriend was participating in the assault or in the threat. I mean, other than the fact that she was there in the crowd. Was there any evidence that the actual victim was perpetrating an assault or anything that would lead the court to give them the self-defense?
I could be wrong, Your Honor, but my understanding was it was not the ex-girlfriend. It was one of the other participants in the assault that was there actively chasing these two down and participating in the assault.
Maybe I misunderstood. Wasn't Barley the ex-girlfriend or something?
I don't believe so. I don't recall the names, but I do believe it was one of the other male assailants rather than the ex-girlfriend. I could be wrong, Your Honor. If I may, Justice Tiarina, you raised a point about this collateral issue as well, about whether or not the trial court should have allowed them to get into this extraneous matter. And I would just like to point out that I think you're correct. The defenses can be raised even in opening statement, which then allows the other party to attempt to rebut that statement. And that's a different question than whether at the close of the evidence the defendant has actually proved the defense that he raises. The state is allowed to anticipate certain defenses when the defendant makes it clear he's going to raise those and to rebut them.
Well, and in this case, wasn't it, absolutely positively clear that they were going to raise self-defense? Because in order to raise it, you have to admit that you actually did. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. And I think it's an entirely separate question as to whether or not the trial court at that point says the door is open, the state can attempt to rebut this, as opposed to once the evidence is closed, has the defense actually met its burden on that defense? An entirely separate question, the state would suggest. The crux of the case, though, I think goes back.
But I think the problem that I have with the evidence that comes in to rebut what ultimately is not given to the jury goes back to the standard that this trial court must put into question when he's deciding whether there's a self-instruction charge is that as long as there's some evidence, and I think that the evidence to rebut the self-defense is what gives us the rise to some evidence. I think that's where I get caught in that catch, as the appellant pointed out, in that catch-22. Why would you have to rebut a self-defense, which leads to the fact that then there was some evidence
of self-defense and thus being given the jury charge on that. You see what I mean? I mean, it's one of those circular arguments on this case. It drives me nuts every day.
If I can try to explain why I think that's logical for the state to do. The state, the defendant, can raise all kinds of defenses, potential defenses, in its opening or suggest that that's the path it's going to travel. The state at that point is certainly allowed to, in its examination of witnesses and its presentation of evidence, to try to cut that off at the base, to try to show evidence that would suggest, no, that's not a credible defense. The defendant then at that point may continue to try to urge that defense and present evidence of it, or they may abandon it. But the state's ability to try to cut them off at the knees, so to speak, is still there. And at the end of the day, I think the relevant question is going to be, did evidence come in which would be at least a scintilla of evidence which would allow the jury to determine that this was, the deadly force was used in response to either the perception of deadly force being used against the defendant or the perception of a robbery, of an imminent robbery occurring in which he would use deadly force to prevent the robbery.
Okay, counsel, going back to the, I hate to harp on the Jordan case, but I've looked at it, and one of the victims was the girlfriend, Summer Varley. And so the court in that case said that self-defense could have even been used to defend against the assault that occurred on someone who clearly was just a semi-participant in the event but wasn't the direct assailant.
Then you're correct, Your Honor, and I misread that. But I think in the Jordan case, there was still an indication that all people were participating in it. I would be surprised if they were saying that all you have to do is stand on the sidelines and deadly force can be used against you. In fact, I think the person against whom deadly force was actually used in that case was the person who was on top of the defendant.
No, he shot Royal in the leg, who was
Royal
the assailant,
the
and he hit Varley in the chest. I guess probably the one who got the brunt of this was the girlfriend, which I don't, looking at the Varley case, I guess what the scant record that is contained in the opinion doesn't really talk about Varley being in any way aggressive or the assailant in this case. And yet in that case, you know, as recently as 2 days ago, the court felt that there was sufficient, or the Court of Appeals felt that this, even under these facts, that the self-defense should have been allowed again to protect or to defend in against just somebody who was just happened to be there.
I would be surprised if they were saying just somebody who happened to be there, but I think the opinion would turn on whether or not, you know, the multiple assailants could be viewed as a group,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of a multiple assailants question. In Jordan, nonetheless, the force that was being exerted against the defendant in that case was significantly more than the force being exerted against this defendant, and I would say they're distinguishable on that matter. Now, there may be subtle questions about the degree of participation of one assailant with another, but that's not really the case here. It's sort of apples and oranges compared to our case, where there's clearly only one assailant and one defendant.
Well, I think that what I took away, and I did not read Jordan as detailed as Justice Inhofe and Justice DeGeneres, I will admit, because we got it so late and none of us saw it till late last night. So, but one of the things that I took from Jordan in perusing it was, again, going back to that low level that the appellant addresses in the opening argument this morning, that very low threshold that you need in order to get a self-defense instruction. And that's, I think, what I took away from Jordan, taking away the nuances of the facts, because the facts are always going to be different for every case. But it's that initial low threshold that we have to look that, as a matter of law, did the defendant reach it in this case and so was entitled to a self-instruction charge. Leading to a question that I want to go back, that you talk early on in your argument about, and in your brief, about this distinguishing between speculation and inference, that I thought was what this whole case was, what the appellant in this case arguing speculative to give a self-defense charge, or is it truly a legal inference that allows him to get the self-instruction charge?
That's exactly where I think this case falls.
Right.
Is it speculation or is it reasonable inference? And the facts of this case, if you look at the facts that the defendant was aware of at the time, and I think the easiest way to look at it is to take the incident itself. The incident itself is, if we remove some of the other facts, the incident itself is the defendant is in a room, another man barges into the room and approaches him with closed fist in an aggressive manner. Defendant points a gun at him, says, halt. He doesn't halt. He's still approaching with closed fist. Apparently nothing is said by the man who's approaching him. At that point, I'd say the defendant clearly has the right to use force to protect himself against a fist fight, a non-deadly force. I don't think at that point anybody could say he then has the right to use deadly force against that attack. It hasn't risen to that level yet. So
add to your facts.
Yes, Your Honor.
Just before that occurs. Here's glass breaking, because it's uncontroverted, glass breaking and yelling in the hallway before he breaks in.
Yes, Your Honor.
Doesn't that give rise more to, holy crap, someone's coming in to do some harm to me and I need to use deadly force?
I'm not sure it gets you to the deadly force, though. He hears glass breaking. Maybe he can infer that somebody's breaking in. It's not his house.
Is that an inference we can make without it being speculative?
I would say not yet, but that's on the cusp there. This is why this case is on the cusp. He hears glass breaking. He hears some sort of commotion, and then the man enters the room there. Is it reasonable to infer from that commotion and the glass breaking, does that turn what's obviously aggression in the form of a fist fight, non-deadly force, does that turn into a reasonable speculation that it's going to be deadly force? And I would say no, not without more facts, not without more of an indication. Now, their two theories are that deadly force was going to be used. He had the right to apprehend or to believe that deadly force would be used against him, or that he had the right to believe that a robbery was going to be imminently occurring against
him.
Well,
and let's talk about the robbery part, too, because at that point, isn't there a line of cases, I think you bring it up, where if somebody breaks into your house in the middle of the night or into a house where you are in, that you can sort of assume that they're there to steal?
You can, but stealing doesn't necessarily equate to a robbery of this particular person under these circumstances in which deadly force would be necessary to prevent the person from obtaining property from him or continuing to assert control over it. We don't have anything else that would indicate that this person broke in with a specific intent when he, broke in there, went into the room, that it was his intent to rob the defendant.
And don't we lose that presumption? We talked about it earlier. When you're engaged in criminal activity, then you have to rebut that presumption with regards to reasonableness, use of deadly force. Because when you're sitting innocently at home and someone breaks into your house, then you can presume that maybe they're there to steal something. But if you're otherwise engaged in criminal activity, I think that presumption is lost. Is that correct?
Well, I wish I could say yes, Your Honor.
I was going to say, the presumption is not lost.
But I have to say, I think it's sort of different. It's the same general idea, but one is a statutory presumption that he does lose. You're right, Your Honor. But the other is sort of a common law presumption that when somebody's breaking in, they're there to steal, at night anyway. And in this case, in the first place, it's a sort of an inference that he was there breaking into a house he had no right to be in the first place, because he didn't know whether, the person had permission or not. Now, there's a lot of testimony in there from Mercedes and other sources as to whether he did or didn't have permission to be there. But from the defendant's standpoint, he didn't know anything about that. He heard some glass breaking. He heard a commotion. Maybe he can infer. I'll, concede. Maybe he can infer somebody was breaking into the house. The presumption that we get, the common law presumption, is that when it's at night and the lights are off, that you can presume they're there to steal. And I think that presumption is based, at least in part, on the idea they're there to steal something without being caught. That's the whole point of breaking into a person's house at night when the lights are off. Here you have a different scenario. Not only is he breaking into the house, but he's going to that room and he's going to aggressively confront this person. There's no indication he was there to steal from him. There's no indication that deadly force at that point was necessary to prevent some sort of a robbery, which we have no indication was ultimately occurring. And there's really no indication, unless you want to engage in speculation, that either deadly force or a robbery, that the defendant was in a position to believe deadly force or a robbery were occurring. There are a lot of things the defendant could have said. He could have said, well, you know, Mercedes was acting funny, and I heard in the hallway when this guy broke in, she said, go get him, he's in the room there. He could have had said, he could have testified, you know, when the guy broke in, he said, give me your money. None of that happened. And that's why I believe this falls on the cusp of speculation rather than reasonable inference.
Counsel, before you run out of time, I wanted to ask you this whole thing about that on the motion for new trial, that, you know, it's just based on pleadings and affidavits and that there was no actual hearing. Wouldn't you agree with me that when there's an issue regarding ex parte communications, that by its very nature, that's an issue that cannot be determined by the record and therefore does require testimony?
I see my time's up, but may I?
Please answer, yes.
I believe at that point it's a factual issue, but it doesn't necessarily have to be determined at an evidentiary hearing. The trial court can decide motions for a new trial based on affidavits as well or other types of evidence. It's within his discretion to decide whether he's going to hear this at a live evidentiary hearing or based on other manners of determining the facts.
Sure, and that would probably apply 99% of the time, but not in ex parte communications, because at that point the judge may not be too keen on having, determining granting a new trial when he's sort of at the crux of it, because he would have to find that he did engage in an ex parte communication that warranted a new trial. I mean, the whole purpose of having a hearing is for there to be a record for us to consider, and if the defendant is not allowed testimony of that he witnessed an ex parte communication or that he's aware of an ex parte communication, then we're not going to have the benefit of that record. Isn't that a fact?
If I may, Your Honor, you'll have the benefit of the record of the affidavits. You won't have the benefit of a live evidentiary hearing. And, you know, in candor to the court, you know, a live evidentiary hearing probably would have been the prudent thing to do, but I don't think it was required by the law. The law gives the judge wide discretion to determine things by affidavit or by a live hearing. If the parties thought that because of the trial judge's close contact with this case, he should be recused, they could have done that as well. But I don't think that's before the court.
And can my recollection, my time on the trial bench, a motion for new trial can be overruled by operation of law, correct, after expiration of so many days? Is that correct?
Oh, yes, Your Honor, yes.
So there didn't have to be a ruling at all?
There didn't have to be that, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Well, my time is up, unless there are other questions.
Any other questions? Okay, Mr. Wright, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honors, I'd like to begin where Mr. Norman began, which is the issue of whether the court's response to the jury note is before this tribunal. It is. First of all, our opening brief met the standards for raising an issue under Texas Appellate Rule 38.1F. But second, the reason this issue is before this court is because in our reply brief, we filed a motion with the same reply brief asking that we be given permission to amend our opening brief to raise the issue as point five, that the court's response was a legal error. This court granted that motion. So that issue is squarely before this court. As to instructing the jury, you have the original jury instructions themselves, which we contend are legal error, and the court's response to the jury's note.
Here's the way I see it, though. If we decide that the self-instruction should not be given, doesn't that make the comment moot, the whole issue moot? Because we decided they shouldn't have been given the self-instruction charge anyway. It only becomes an issue if you were entitled to get the self-instruction charge, and in such case, this court would have reversed already. So you don't get to it at all. Do you understand my question? If we decide against you in the first issue, we don't get to the comment.
I understand your point, Your Honor. I disagree to the extent because the court went so far in his comment on the evidence.
So you think we still get to it even if we were to decide that you were not that Mr. Wright was not entitled to a self-instruction?
I do,
charge.
Your Honor, because with the court's comments, if you look at the verbiage in the note back to the jury, The court, in his "I have already ruled, self-defense does not apply to this case, you are not to consider it," is commenting on the reasonableness of the grand jury testimony in which Mr. Wright repeatedly articulates his only defense, self-defense, and repeatedly does that by saying, "I thought the man was going to attack me. I thought he was going to tag my back. I thought Mercedes Barrios had set me up to be robbed. He wouldn't stop. He just kept coming at me." The factual record before that jury was replete with facts that supported and fulfilled the elements of self-defense. So by commenting, "I have already ruled on this, you are not to consider it," the court is commenting on the evidence and basically telling the jury it's not reasonable to even consider this grand jury testimony in your deliberations. I'd like to also discuss this idea of speculation versus elements, or speculation versus inference. Thank you. The elements for self-defense are met in this case. And that is because, as Jordan v. State points out, and this is why we brought it to the court's attention, yes, the facts are slightly different, but the legal standard used is that if there is some evidence viewed in the light most favorable to the defendant, and when you look back at the court, who laid out in great detail in the record as to why he was denying that instruction, not only does he take only select facts from the grand jury testimony, in fact, he literally only takes one, Mr. Wright's statement that he thought the man was coming at him and would take the gun away from him, he then applies the totally wrong legal standard. He only looks at Penal Code Section 9.32A2A, the apparent danger. The trial court's consideration of this issue when denying the instruction totally ignored the issue of robbery, an attempted robbery. He didn't even consider it. And the cases in which the trial court cited, and he specifically referred to this court, knowing that you'd be reviewing this record, he cites two cases, one of which does not even involve a jury instruction. It was a case cited to the bench. Another in which the defendant actually got a jury instruction, and it was a sufficiency of the evidence case. And a third, the one he hangs his hat on, Holmes v. State, in which there is no reasonable apprehension of danger. Those aren't the facts here. The facts are, and the court asked Mr. Norman about this, this presumption that when Mr. Barrios breaks into the apartment that he's there to steal, that legal presumption is still afforded to Mr. Wright. What's not afforded to him presumption-wise is whether he was reasonable. That's for the fact finder to decide. They never got that chance. Because when the trial court denied that jury instruction, what this trial became was a long, painful, slow guilty plea.
Counsel, let me refresh my memory. What was the question itself that was asked that the jury posed to the court?
What is the law on self-defense? Can you provide? It was two questions. What's okay. The law on self-defense, and can you provide us what Texas law is? Question mark. I mean, the jury was crying out to understand what the law on self-defense is, and that's because the elements for self-defense were met. Mr. Norman mentioned that there was nothing there to indicate that the man, Mr. Barrios, had entered that apartment to steal. That's only true if you look at the facts in the light unfavorable to the defendant. That's not the law here, and Jordan says that. And in fact, Gilboa says that too, on facts that are strikingly similar to this case. And I point this court's attention to Gilboa, which we cite in our letter brief. In there, the defendant faced two men who were apparently intoxicated, unarmed, who wouldn't stop coming at him. He tells them, "Hold up," with a gun drawn, and one takes two steps forward and he shoots because he thought he was going to receive the beating of his life, and he was panicked and scared. I submit to this court that the same factual circumstances exist here.
Well, wouldn't that mean, though, that anyone engaged in any type of criminal activity then would be justified in self-defense upon confronting someone they didn't know or were startled by someone they didn't know, somebody knocking on their window when they're inside their car because they think they're going to be robbed?
That's a great question, Your Honor. And I submit the answer is no, for a couple reasons. One, you've got to fulfill that element of imminence. And in fact, there are cases that the trial court cited to, one of which in which that idea of imminence was missing.
But then don't you have to, bifurcate those two issues? The one you say that he was afraid that he was going to be, or deadly force was going to be used on him, completely separate, and the other one that he was going to be robbed. And there has to be some evidence that he perceived that he was going to be robbed. And the only reason he believes that is because he's engaged in criminal activity. Is that correct?
It's not exactly accurate, Your Honor. Mr. Wright testified, and that is some evidence. The testimony of defendant, as Jordan v. State points out and Gilbo points out, is some evidence. Mr. Wright testified twice before the grand jury. He believed that Mrs. Barrios had set him up to be robbed. And the other evidence there, beyond his belief...
Did he provide any evidence to that effect other than his own statement?
Yes. The other evidence is there are drugs and money in the room. He also has money on his person. And the stranger that breaks into the apartment where Mr. Wright had been only twice before is dressed in black and blue to, you know, apparently colors that conceal your identity. And finally, I would note that Mr. Wright is in this bedroom at night with a woman who is moments before communicating with an unknown person who goes out into the hall, and while there's a commotion, doesn't say, I need help, let me call the police. There's a commotion, and then this man comes charging at him. These are all facts that support a reasonable apprehension of danger
and
robbery.
And when the glass was broken and someone entered the house and she went to the living room, he made no attempt to go with her, to help her, because he was afraid when that happened?
Actually, the testimony is that she told him to stay there and then partially closed the door. It was her home, and so he did what he was told. But I get what the court is saying. I understand the reticence here. Yes, there were drugs and money involved. Yes, Mrs. Barrios was engaged in drug dealing. But even if there are other cases where a similar shooting or events, you've still got to meet the elements of self-defense with some evidence. And the facts in this record show those elements were met. And this was the only defense the defendant put forward. And without this jury instruction, this trial was the functional equivalent of a directed verdict of guilty. Because of that, we ask that this court reverse the judgment and remand to the trial court for a new trial so that the fact finder may determine the reasonableness of Mr. Wright's sole defense.
Counsel, if I guess what you're saying, I guess, is logical in that why would he even go to the jury? I mean, it was undisputed that he shot him, and if it wasn't in self-defense, then, I mean, what else did the jury have to consider?
That's exactly it, Your Honor. You know, the reality is that it's for the jury to decide whether or not Mr. Wright was reasonable in taking these actions, not for the trial court. That's the law in Texas.
But it's up to the trial court to decide as a matter of law whether there was sufficient evidence, and we don't know that until all the evidence is done at the close of case. I mean, it's a gamble, as Judge Hirina mentions. You hope you present enough evidence, but it's up to the trial court to decide whether there is enough evidence that you met that threshold.
It is, but it's a very low threshold, Your Honor, and the law is clear on that.
But it has to be inference and not speculation.
Correct. We believe that's met here. Thank you.
And time's up. We will take it under submission.